Welcome to eHealth Learning, inspiring professionals worldwide.
Good. So welcome, everybody, and a particularly warm welcome to David Zulak. He's talking to us from Paris in Ontario, Canada. And it's the first time we've had David on eHealth Learning. It's a really delightful to have you here. David is a handspring author and has written the book Clinical Assessment for Manual Therapy, A Practical Guide. And he'll be talking about that a little bit later and also giving a discount code for that book if you'd like to buy it from Handspring. He's going to be talking today about dermatomes and myotomes and how to assess them and how useful they are in clinical assessment. And of course, very open to questions as we go through, which I can put to David. And David's been a massage therapist and a teacher since 1994 and teaches a lot about anatomy and clinical assessment in various massage schools in Canada. So welcome, David. Thank you for being here today. Great. Alrighty. So this subject of dermatomes and myotomes, you've obviously, you're going to cover how useful this is in clinical practice, aren't you? A little bit as well. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah, perfect.
So as the title says, it's a discussion on dermatomes and myotomes, and it's just a brief introduction. Like many things in clinical assessment, we're taking a little portion of a bigger protocol. So this would fall under all the neurological testing one might do for a person who comes in with specific neurological problems. But the one of the advantages also though of understanding dermatomes and myotomes is how they help us understand how the body's organized and how they play a role in things like referred pain, radiating pain, etc. But we'll keep it very simple. And my understanding was that we just wanted to give as clear as possible a definition without, you know, coding it too much, and then try to give an understanding of what we're talking about when we are talking about dermatomes and myotomes, or anybody's talking to you about dermatomes and myotomes. And there. So reasons why it can be helpful to know about dermatomes and myotomes. Knowing even the basics of them helps us to understand some important points about how our nervous system is organized. And if you know you're going to be a therapist, you want to treat, you could be treating sprains and strains, you could be treating stress, you could be talking psychological issues, all sorts of ways that manual therapy address people. But in the end, you're going to have to deal to some degree with the nervous system, since that's what often runs the show. So understanding them helps us to figure out where the problem or lesion may be when someone has what we call a peripheral nerve lesion, when the peripheral nerve isn't functioning correctly or not functioning at all. So when someone can't do a particular action or they have a altered sensation or lack of sensation in a certain part of their body, is the problem there or is the problem somewhere else? It helps to partially explain how pain is referred or projected. We'll talk about that a bit more later. How it is often, it's often where we feel the pain or the altered sensation may not in fact be where the pain is. And that's a real, among teachers who on all sorts of subjects in manual therapy, when you're talking about pain or altered sensation or weakness, you've got to think that, you know, half the time the problem isn't where the client is pointing to or where you see the impairment. It can actually be at a distance from that spot. So it's one of the ways to understand these things about dermatomes and myotomes, helps to understand some of that neurological referral. So the nurse trying to treat an area where the symptoms are, if that's not also where the lesion is. You're in fact, you know, wasting your treatment time to a certain degree. And you want to be efficient. And so that's what this understanding helps us bring about. Now, it's an introduction up to how many of the structures and functions of the body have been organized. Dermatomes and myotomes, the whole understanding of how the sensory and motor functions of the body work. It gives us an examples also of how the body prioritizes certain information. And this prioritization can be important because the person can be conscious of certain things that are going on because their brain has decided this is a high priority, I'm in pain. And yet other things may also be going on that they will not be aware of, that are left unconscious, but the body still nonetheless is taking all of that into account in a more subconscious or unconscious way. In a preliminary manner, it speaks to how the person senses themselves as embodied. I mean, here that, you know, we have all our senses, we have our eyes and our ears and those things, but it is really our basic sensations, how we feel the world, and how we move in the world. That is what gives us a sense of a body, not just, you know, a mind. So again, so that's part of the reason to talk about this. And it pushes us towards a deeper sense of the unity of body, mind, and spirit in that way, how a person is integrated into a whole. So where we know that, you know, as often says, we can divide the body up into all these systems, and that's sort of a, you know, done on an intellectual level, but we are really are indivisible as a living being, and not even as indivisible as beings. We exist in a world in which we are all, you know, integral to. So anyways, as the complexity of the nervous system is only a reflection of the complexity and interweaving and interconnections of the whole show, life as it is. So, however, we're going to keep it simple to start with. We don't want to go too fast, too hard. So the most simple way to put things is that a dermatome is an area of skin supplied by a single nerve root. So just to be clear about what we mean there. So as the nerves exit the spinal cord, so we just take one level. So between two vertebrae, there's an arch has been made between the parts of the two vertebrae. The nerve comes out. They often call these dorsal nerves in that they are on the sort of back side of the opening and motor are more on the front side. The way to know when you see this word dorsal is just, I always still in my mind, I get the image as soon as I say the word, learning in school, of a dorsal fin of a dolphin coming up out of the water, you know, surfacing. And you see the dorsal fin, well, that's on the back. So the dermatome nerve, the sensory nerve, is on that backside, and it comes out, and then they are going to, these motor and sensory are going to, in various ways, intermingle and carry to different parts of the body. Now, there are 8 cervical nerves, but C1 does not seem to have a dermatome, at least there's no fixed belief in that. There are 12 thoracic nerves. Most of those, of course, are just doing the areas of the rib cage. And there's 5 lumbar nerves and 5 sacral nerves. And the lumbar and some of the sacral are feeding the lower body, while some of the cervical and T1 are feeding the upper limbs in terms of giving us sensory and motor. But here it's just sensory. So each of these spinal nerves relay sensation from a particular discrete region of the skin to the brain. So that a dermatome is, in other words, an area of skin, very distinct, that is covered by one nerve root. So if you were going over that, and say, okay, here's C3, I'm going over C3, and then you'd find that would disappear, and then now you're into C4, you're into C5. They're very distinct in dermatomes. So we can have maps are made of this, and they can slightly vary according to ethnic origins and a few other things, but on the whole, the dermatome patterns go from person to person. So, Now, before we look at a map, a damage to a sensory part of a nerve can cause a loss of sensation or numbness or altering the sensation to that specific area of skin. So C8 is your little finger area. It's a little longer, but so always if here, if you're brushing this area, you'd be getting a sensation. When you feel that, it's going through the C8 nerve. If I'm over on my thumb, it's not going through my C8 nerve. So the area is very specific, and you can have, but you don't just have numbness. You could have tingling, you could have pressure. You get all the things of sense that can happen. So pressure, vibration, hot and cold, this and that, they all belong to that nerve root, which is feeding that specific area of skin. So if you have therefore, by checking around an area of skin that has, you know, numbness, tingling, whatever is going on, and finding that it's only occurring in a very specific dermatonal area that's been mapped out, you now know which nerve root is affected, okay? So while the brain is assuming that here there's a problem here, this is where the burning is happening or the numbness is happening, but actually it's the problem, the lesion lies up in my spine. And that's the most important thing about dermatomes and myotomes is that they're letting you know about spinal lesions over and above whether something is happening locally. The nerve was cut just before that point or whatever. So let's see. So the best way is to have a visual image. So these are like the dermatomes of the upper body. So you can see how, like, if you look at the hand, you can see that C6 is the thumb. C7 we take as the middle finger. It can vary a little bit person to person. And C8 is the little baby finger area. So if you have a lesion for whatever reason, it could be something as bad as a tumor. It could be simply a disc protruding onto that nerve root that's causing an altered sensation or interfering with the signaling from an injury, trauma, whatever. Only that area of specific innervation will have the symptoms. They don't travel across. So when someone has a larger area of that same sensation, the tingling is all over the whole hand, for example, well, it could be a peripheral nerve, what we call these axillary, median, ulnar. But on the other hand, it could also be blood flow. So we can have symptoms like tingling, numbness, weakness, whatever. And we could have a number of causes. They could be blood flow will cause those problems, nerve roots issues will cause those problems, and then what we refer to as the peripheral nerves, damage to them could be causing the problem. So we have to sort these out. They can share certain qualities. But the one thing about dermatomes is that when you're doing your neurological testing, if you find only a specific area of skin has the problem that matches your dermatome map that you have in front of you, then you know that the problem is at the nerve root, not farther down the arm or in the hand itself. Okay, that's the biggest reason to understand your dermatomes. So is that clear so far? Is that clear enough? I think we've got it pretty simple. Any confusion?
Yep. That's great. They have a word in German, David, called kribbling, which I really like. It's like these sensations that you might get, like tingling or numbness, and they just call it kribbling. Yeah.
you can get a whole lot of technical terms. You can talk about dysthesia and anesthesia and all that. Yeah, they can describe the various things, but.
David, could you just say something about like when people get, because it sometimes can be a red flag, kind of like if you get these kind of sensations in both limbs, so both hands or both feet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. When it's bilateral, we would say, in both hands, both feet, both legs, the problem is still most likely in the cord, spinal cord, but it's not at the nerve root level per se. Those nerve roots go into the spinal cord, and that spinal cord is existing within a bony tube. And so if you get what they call a stenosis in that tube, that the bony growth can happen, and you literally start to squeeze that area, that section of the spine. And though they can somewhat still be a slightly different side to side, but when you get a bilateral one, you're going to worry about that the spinal cord itself is under pressure or compression. And that's a spinal stenosis, as they call it. It's very common. It's good when it does happen. It can happen in the neck, a little in the thoracic, but probably the most common place is actually in the low back. And people think they have sciatica, for example, but they have sciatica down the back of both legs. That really is quite a red flag that, as you say, we really need to take a better look. And that's usually going to require something like an MRI. But it should be something that you are aware of. It's a good point to bring up that while a single nerve root can have some significant problems, let's say like a disc herniation causing it, or osteophytes coming out of a facet joint in the spine that are rubbing on the nerve and irritating it, those things can in many ways be treated by decompression, other ways, postural changes, strengthening of the core, various things like that, can all sorts of things come to play. But something about spinal stenosis is something where the body itself, for an unknown reason, has decided to, the spinal canal is shrinking. And that's a more serious issue. Usually requires surgery. They'll take a piece of the bone out sometimes so that let it expand. Cool. Does that make
sense? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I've seen some dermatome charts, David, when they put the body like it's a four-legged animal, and you can see the I don't know if you've seen those where because when you look at like the lumbar dermatomes and the sacrum, they can look a bit complicated, but like when you look at it in a four-legged animal, they're kind of straight down. It kind of makes it a bit easier, I feel, sometimes.
For people sometimes create like that barber pole sort of spiral in the legs, and that there is an assumption that yes, that you know, you see that the ones down the arm seem to go straight down, and you know, nicely organized that way, but then the legs seem to curve around, and that has to do apparently as in vitro, when we're developing, that the legs literally do rotate, and all of those tissues bend into that area.
Okay.
And so if we were a four-legged animal, we would, those lower, I don't have a lot of the lower body, but you can see how they do sort of spiral over.
Yep.
Those would actually look straighter in a four-legged animal than in us.
Yeah.
And this is sort of a rotation that occurs as the body is developing within the fetus.
Okay, cool.
It is actually an interesting sort of thing to note that that has sort of occurred.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Thank you. Great.
So we'll move on to a myotome. We can come back and discuss the both, but we want to distinguish it, Bam. So the dermatome was an area of skin innervated by a single nerve root, sensory information at different types. It could be touch, hot, cold, vibration, pressure, whatever. Now, myotome is traditionally, they say a myotome refers to the muscles served by a spinal nerve root motor's portion. So a myotome is simply the motor part of that nerve coming out of the neuroforamen. So the dermatome was the sensory part that comes into that one nerve, and the myotome is the motor part that's going to drive the muscular system of the body. Now, as is pointed out here in the note, I didn't use the term single nerve root innervating a specific muscle because it's a little bit, it'd be lovely to say that because you know people like these simple things that keep building this way, but there are always complications to some degree. And it's what it does actually is, and we're going to go to the second part of this slide, because for the large muscles of the body, a myotome refers to the dominant motor nerve root that controls a specific action of a muscle group. In other words, one nerve root is thought to dominate a particular action when that group of muscles has several motor nerves actually going into it. This happens in the larger muscles. So the example I use here is hip flexors. So the iliopsoas, you know, is innervated by three basic nerve roots, L2, L3, and L4. Yet, when its primary action is, you know, flexion, it has other actions, that the L2 is the myotome for flexion that you can test. It dominates. If you lost L2, flexion would be quite decreased. So it's not just, always, and these are in groups of muscles. So, you know, so why we have individual names for muscles, I know that osteopaths quite freely, and I think correctly to some degree, it seems like a generalization, but they'll talk about the flexors of the hips, the adductors of the hips, the rotators of the hips. And in that sense, while that sounds sort of vague and generalized, they really are staying true to this idea of what spinal level is going to drive that action the most. So again, so let's say in flexion, I test someone's hip flexion with some resistance. They try to lift their knee while they're sitting on the table and I hold it down. And I check one side and the other side. One side is strong and the other side is weak. That weakness, I'll note later, it is an important point, when there's no pain, but there's weakness, that lets me think, this is happening actually in their low back at the spinal level L2. So while Dermatones was nice in the sense of very clear single nerve root that innervates a very specific area of skin, we're not innervating necessarily a myotome, a specific muscle, but we're talking about muscle groups and what their particular action is. So flexors of the hip, sensors of the hip, whatever. Those are how we will check the myotomes. That makes some sense? So you can see there's a little difference, but there's a little bit of a change. So therefore, when someone complains of weakness in a limb, or when they're doing a specific activity and you test that activity or that muscle group, I can't, you know, I'm having trouble walking upstairs as one leg doesn't want to lift when I go up. You can, by testing the various actions, hip flexion, hip extension, knee extension, et cetera, you can find out if, and you find this weakness without pain, you can then say this nerve root area level is what's involved, and therefore there may be some lesion at the nerve root. Not necessarily somewhere along the nerve, but at the nerve root. Because it's not too long before the nerves leave the spine, that of course many of them start to intermingle, right, into plexus, so the lumbar plexus, and they all join up, and L3 may go to three different nerves, and L4 may go to two different nerves. Some of them be the same. Anyway, it becomes like a really bad motorway. When which exit do I take? Anyway, it can become quite confusing, but we don't want to get into that. It hurts the brain when you're a student learning that stuff. Okay. But it does let us know where, again, we've got a lesion in the spine and we know where that is. Now, again, for many of us, I'm not treating lesions in the spine per se. I might try to open up facet joints. I might try some decompression, but this becomes a somewhat of a red flag also in that I will say, I think you should have this investigated further, right? So I might, if I was just saying, you've got this weakness here, let's just give you some exercises to treat that. Or in the case of a Dermatone, you've got some altered sensation, I'll just treat that area right there. I'm not providing what the treatment that may be appropriate. And this, for many manual therapists, this may be a referral out time to someone who does deal with those problems specifically. So it's one way rather than, it prevents us from doing treatments that don't help, and knowing, on the other hand, also who we need to send them to for them to have help. Because, no medical profession of any sort really can do everything to help a person all across the board, right? We all have our little specialties. Okay, so here testing is done by resisting a specific action. So it could be like, I'm going to have you bend your elbow, or I'm going to make you bend your head to one side, but I'm going to resist it. I'm going to give you match the resistance. And when I see the weakness on one side, without any pain being generated by the resistance, I then have I can be fairly confident that there's a nerve root issue going on there. So now, same thing, note that charts of myotomes can also vary. So just like I said, sometimes dermatomal maps of the areas of the skin can be a little slightly different here or there. The same thing can happen with myotomes, but only in this way. In that often some myotome maps will tell you all the nerve roots of a muscle that are involved in a specific action, not just a dominant one. So they might say of the flexors of the hip, it's L2, 3, 4, rather than just number 2. It's true that all 2, 3, and 4. But the point being is that the action is most affected by a loss at L3. So when we talk about a myotome map, the one we're talking about is the one that helps us test to find the motor nerve root at what level is a problem I need to go investigate or have someone investigate. Or if you're doing, or whatever your modality is, that you're, it could be energy work, it could be cranial work, for example, or it could be mechanical fascial work, whatever, you want to, you know, decompress the spine in some way, or you want to change the movement of fluids, or you want to use acupuncture. The advantage is you're not thinking about, oh, there's a problem here. The problem, I know, there may be some information I can send from here there to help, but I also need to address at the origin, right? At the nerve root itself. Okay, so those, the charts we're interested in are those ones. And I think, yeah, so I have an example right here. Here's a long list. These would be principally the nerve roots that you could test. So if I want to test C1 and 2, this is one has 2 because they're not sure whether C1 actually has a myotome, but that's not the end of that. So if I you know, resist a person, you know, hold forehead, stabilize the back, and I say, okay, try to flex your head. And if they feel I just can't push, then I know that may be it. On the other hand, say, no, that's fine. But now I put a hand on the side and I say, okay, try to take your ear to his shoulder. This side's fine. I got nothing. I can't. And you'd feel that they just couldn't generate. Shoulder shrugging, trying to push the shoulders down, shoulder abduction, wrist extension. And it's all, you can go all the way down these things that would tell you. As soon as you redo these resistance of these motions, you can then know pretty large level of certainty which level is being impaired at the exiting of the nerve root. Now, I was going to mention something here about, I don't know if I have my notes. No, that's okay. Now, when you notice that it stops at T1, T1, the first thoracic nerve, sends some off with the cervical, lower cervicals to help with the shoulder and arm. T2 to 12 is missing only in the sense that there's not very specific actions, and those motor nerve roots are usually just doing the intercostal muscles at that level, and some of the very, very deep, fine, sometimes intrinsic muscles of the spine, those that literally help guide and shift and move the vertebrae in a way so that the joints move in the correct pattern and movement, but they rotate and slide and turn so that when the big muscles engage, we don't, you know, pull things out of position. So there's really almost no testing of the thoracics per se, but you can, of course, test the sensory. You would find as you go down the ribs, say that you were going down the side of the ribs, that all of a sudden, I feel that, I feel that, I feel that, and then I don't. And then I feel again, it comes back below. But certainly the predominance is the upper portion, the cervicals, And then the lumbars and sacral are the ones that we run into as the most often injured for various reasons. The thoracics have a lot of protection in the sense that they have ribs. They've got a lot of paraspinal muscles that protect them, while the cervical and the lumbar are a little bit more susceptible to injury. Are we okay so far?
Yeah, it's good. David, how does the fact that the spinal cord finishes around T12, L1 in most people, how does it affect this?
Yes, so when the cord comes to the end, and then what they call the rest of the, usually around L1 or 2, depending on the person and who's counting, let's say it's L1 area, then L2, 3, 4, 5, and all the sacral and coccygeal nerves, they come out as strings. And someone at some point thought, oh, that looks like a horse's tail. So they called it a cauda equina, equina horse. So those are still coming out at the nerve root. So we are still assuming that the problem wouldn't be in the spinal canal per se, unless it was a stenosis. And then we get more, not always, but more likely to get symptoms on both sides. But they still act the same as they exit the foramen. They're already joined motor and sensory, but you can compress one side more than the other. You don't have to get both dermatome and myotome at any nerve root, both under compression or under lesion. You can in fact have one or the other and both. They're all possible. So, but the fact, as you say, that cauda equina being there doesn't really change how things happen at the area of the nerve root. Now, this is probably because we feel that in many ways, other than a few unusual situations, let's say spinal stenosis, injury at nerves exiting from coming out of the central nervous system, the first spot that they're can run into trouble, can be injured, et cetera, is at the nerve root level. And what we mean by root is simply as those roots blend together out of the spinal cord and they start exiting that neural foramen. Then you've got the disc that can give you some grief. There's even ligaments that, you know, we think of ligaments as sort of structures just between bones, but fascinating photo I saw of a cadaver photo where little ligaments sort of passing, crisscrossing in the middle of a neural foramen, and the fibers having to sort of go through that and then join together later. So there's issues there, or as I say, the facet joints, if they have arthritis, and they bony growth happens around the edge of those facet joints, and it can stick out into that neural foramen, almost like literally scrape the nerve or compress it. And or certainly if you if you sublux, as the chiropractors and osteopaths like to talk about, if that joint surfaces are moved in such a way that they don't come back to normal and say one is a little bit more out of place than the other, isn't where it should be, that surface could be impinging. So anyway, there's a whole bunch of dangerous stress when the nerves leave home. off to go, guys. When you have the spinal cord has no more control over what happens to them, you know, the trouble can begin right from that point on.
Yeah. I know, David, I know that some therapists look at, for example, sensitivity on the spinous processes as perhaps an indication of something to do with the sensory dorsal part. And then as some might say, well, if it's more sensitive on the transverse processes, which are obviously more difficult to get at, that might indicate more to do with the motor part. Is that, do you think that's accurate or not, would you say?
The problem with that would be is that there are what they call recurrent nerves. So as the nerves are coming out, some nerves will slide out from the main trunk of the nerve that's going to go out. They will come off. And they will say they could, motor ones could innervate the paraspinal musculature. And some can come out and sensory or the dermatomal sensory part and do the, you know, the joint capsule of the facet, the bone right there. And so while that may be true, so it could be like a, yeah, rule of thumb sort of thing, that if you tapped and you found that that sensory, that level had a sensory problem, but it could be true that just what they call the recurrent nerve is injured, not necessarily the bulk of the nerve root that's traveling. So on the other hand, though, if you turn this around and say, okay, I have someone here who has, they've got some numbness in their thumb. It seems to be, you know, the rest of the hand seems to be okay. It's just basically the thumb area that could be C6. And so then if you then went and tapped at C6 and you could get, also find a lack of sensation or an altered sensation there, that could simply add more weight to that level, maybe having a problem. So I meant by putting it around is just because you lost, you didn't have, you had a different sensation as you tap down the spinous process and say, ah, I got a problem here at T7. That could simply be recurrent and not the rest of the sensory nerve, mm-hmm. right? But if you had the sensory nerve, you probably, problem and you had located, you thought what it was, and you just maybe want to just, you know, do a little check or whatever, see what's also happening at the very local area. Going down and tapping the spine could be very useful in terms of, yes, sort of adding another piece of evidence, mm-hmm. and then also talking to how those are those recurrent nerves being affected along with the rest of the sensory or the rest of the motor nerve root. Cool. Is that okay?
Yeah, perfect. Yeah,
I think that would be true. I don't think you could. So it's and I talk about students a lot. A lot of testing is rule of thumb, right? You could have a lot of exceptions why you could get a false positive or a false negative, and you've always got to be aware that there could be other reasons. It's one reason why, and I talk about this in my book a lot. You've always got to keep a bigger picture. The problem with assessment, you could see how we could start to do this with this sort of stuff, especially, you could start to get so focused. I'm just looking at this dermatome. I'm going to check the motor part of that that matches that dermatome. And you're only paying attention to that, and you're not paying attention to what the rest of the body is doing to help compensate, what strains this might be doing to other tissues, right? Whatever. And so to just focus your attention on that and just to say, oh, all we could do is treat that. There's nothing else to do. Well, no, there might be lots that, again, say massage. There's all sorts of issues going on in that limb in terms of maybe possibly changes in the sympathetic nervous system, how it's functioning, which would affect tissue health, which affects blood flow. And so what we will do is we will mechanically keep that blood flow moving, drainage working, give some exercise to keep that muscle turning on and off. While it's being investigated, is there a more serious problem? These problems are not going to disappear until we see what's happening at that nerve root and something is done maybe for it. But that could simply be also decompression of the area, right?
Cool.
So as I say, you've got to, you know, I just want to use that as an example. If you could see how we could get super focused on this little tiny spot, the neural foramen and the roots coming out, yet we have to keep that bigger picture always around.
Right? Sure. There's a quick question here about the vagus nerve. Has the vagus got any relevance to what you're talking about here?
Not here per se, because the advantage of why we got into myotomes is it's, oh, look, if I resist this action, I can get, you know, a response. And if I get a lack of response, oh, I know there's a problem. The vagal nerve innervating organs and other things, but, you know, mainly it's often thought about organs. The problem is you can't say, oh, I'm going to make my stomach do something to see whether it's working right. Or I'm going to make my liver do something so it'll give me a signal right away. There's always a delay. And so so the vagal nerve becomes difficult. The one cranial nerve, though, that would fall into here, and I have an excerpt that people can go and actually download that for my textbook. And in there, you'll see there's three images that show you, oh, well, what about the face? Because we never talked about Dermatones, the face, are the trigeminal nerve. So there's one branch, second branch, the third branch, right? So that is certainly one cranial nerve that would get involved in this dermatonal and even potentially myotome area, because they control some specific actions. But the vagal nerve, I could speculate that there might be some issues around, no, because swallowing would be a glossopharyngeal, et cetera. I can't think of off the cuff of my head, and I can't think anyone's ever discussed it, how you could strictly test in this, in the way we're talking about, the functioning of the vagal nerve. The vagal nerve would have to be a more inclusive, a very detective style investigation into general health, how they're responding to stress, what are their cycles in terms of sleep and wakefulness, and all the vagal pathologies that can come with that. And even then, you could see where an injury happened. A lot of the time, I do know that, for example, where we want to think about the vagal nerve in assessment is someone who has whiplash, in that if, and we're always in whiplash with cars, and it's great, because, but we've got head sets to bang, stop our head. But if you could get someone pushes you violently from, hits you in the back, and your head goes back, you could stretch your vagal nerve. And so what you do is, so you would have to note that there was problems with, say, digestion, possibly breathing, other liver functions, kidney functions, etc. If these things, you've got some changes after that event, you might want to say, well, maybe that vagal system needs to be investigated. And then there are modalities to treat those. Some of them, a lot of them have recently, over the last 10, 15 years, come out, polyvagal theories and treatment modalities for those. Cranial could attempt to treat some of those. And so, but it wouldn't be as straightforward. Someone would have to have an issue that you investigate to a very deep level, all the psychological, physiological ways. But you can't get a reflex per se, it's fast enough, I think, to tell you about vagal dysfunction. I probably overtalked that.
It's interesting. We're a bit obsessed with the vagus here on eHealth.
Yes, yes, yes. And it is a big topic. And see, this is where, I mean, I just want to, if I could just digress a little bit here, which is what I with my book, is I include an awful lot of osteopathy, but in terms of like muscle energy, a lot of mechanical assessment of the sacrum, thoracic spine, how facet dysfunctions occur, SI joint dysfunctions, and the like. And that, when I started school, my textbook said, was still saying, medical textbook would tell me, oh, the SI joint doesn't move, you can't move it. It changed quickly after, but usually it was physiotherapists who brought that in by their testing. Anyway, so things are always changing. And clinical assessment, it gets a bad rap in the sense of, oh, it only has to do with this muscle skeletal system. No, it is bigger than that, in that whatever modality that we have, we want to work through, or types of modalities, again, knowing how the body functions in different ways, how its energetic level works, how its mechanical system works, how its nervous system is working, its digestive system, is there something going on with the vagal system? Is there something going on with the parasympathetics, the sympathetics proper, fight or flight? All of these things are part of assessment. And so it's one reason, many books are called orthopedic assessment or clinical orthopedic assessment, but I didn't want to restrict to that. That's what this book is about in many ways, because that's what massage therapists need to know in order to pass their registration exams. But in turn, like SI joints weren't necessarily being tested or a distinctive facet joint issues, whatever. But that seems a little ridiculous to me, because if you're a massage therapist, people want you to treat their back more often than they want you to treat any other part of the body. And if you can't assess something, how can you possibly treat it? So it's the same thing here. I think it just gives people more information. And I think vagal, the long way around here, is I think the vagal has not as yet made, we haven't felt its full impact on the whole medical system, which it is going to do, because there is no doubt about its the importance of the vagal system in our health. There's, I mean, no doubt really whatsoever. Anyway, that was a digression again. Okay, so here's my one little statement about sclerotome. And I'm sorry, but we have to mention it. So a subtitle here in the slide. It has been said that it's an area of bone innervated by a specific sensory nerve root. On the other hand, this does not seem to be actually true. And there can be a lot of overlap when we're doing the mapping about which nerve innervates which area of bone and or periosteum. This may be due to the fact that the bones and limbs are still developing late into embryonic growth and may still be developing just after birth. So they're one of the first things to come out, but they also some of the longest ones to take place. And even after birth, you know, the calcification of the ligament of the tissues. Anyway, hence a mingling of sensory nerves may occur that finally innervate any specific area of bone. And that's why when we talk about dermatomes and myotomes, a lot of the times sclerotomes just aren't brought into the picture. It's pretty hard to see, unless I want to take a very long pin and scratch the surface of someone's bone to know which nerve was being affected, what valuable information I'll get or not. And I believe you've had Robert Libby give some talks with you. You know, his work, and he can give you a good lecture on sclerotomes or not sclerotomes.
Yeah, he did.
His little book is a great book, and he did an excellent little summary on that question. And I'm going to side with Robert that I think sclerotome is we would like it to fit that nice thing, you know, single nerve root innervating, da da da. But I think we should leave that one aside for sclerotomes. And we've got to remember, this is also where some of the confusion happens. We talk about dermatomes and myotomes, and we talk about skin, muscle, and or bone, but all of these terms actually are embryological terms, right? They go back all the way to initial development of the embryo, but we can talk about that a little bit later. So I just wanted to mention sclerotomes so people know, yes, you run across them, you hear about them. How valuable they are to us, it's hard to say. If you need referral patterns, that is, as I would go to Robert Libby's work. He's probably right now probably got the most succinct and accessible information on those. So I'm just passing sclerotomes. I can pretend I didn't see that slide and move on. Anyway, let's get to testing, because otherwise we're gonna. So they've been dermatomes and myotomes and sclerotomes have been mapped for over 100 years. So it's been working on a long time. A lot of it was saline injections into the, you know, to sort of stimulate some pain, and then they would record where it was felt. Anyway, dermatome maps provide a guide to the specific areas. We've already mentioned that, really, it's redundant here. So whether the nerve is lesioned, compressed, injured, otherwise not functioning. In myotome charts, we've already talked about those. Those have already been investigated. That's what, we get this, these charts and that from this long history of investigation. Now, in testing dermatomes, it can be complicated, and I certainly don't want to talk about the complicated because it takes too long. Because again, you know, you could lose just temperature sensation, but maybe not vibratory. I mean, these things can happen. I mean, because there's a lot going on with the sensory nerve. But one thing that, if the sensory nerve is being affected, one thing that does seem to always be, no matter what other thing is added on, like in terms of temperature, vibration, etc., is light touch. So you can use very light touch with either your hand, I say, or your brush, and you can just quickly go over the areas of that you want to test them bilaterally, both at the same time, and have the person tell you, no, I don't feel that as clearly on my right hand as I did my left hand. And, you know, by the area you were brushing at the time, whether that, you know, there's a possible sensory nerve root issue that needs to be looked at. So light touch is always usually involved, and we don't need to necessarily get into pinpricks and putting a lot of pressure or getting hot and cold test tubes or whatever, and torturing people with those sorts of things. So I call it brushing, and you could literally use a small brush or anything that's sort of a light. You don't want to use anything abrasive, and you just simply follow these areas. Now, we had this dermatome map say, oh my goodness, I have to literally follow all the way down where it starts and to the end of, no. What you can do is you can pick the part that every map agrees is and is always distinctly related to that nerve root. So again, if I'm doing 6, 7, 8, I don't trace all the way into the forearm and the sun. I brush the outside of the thumb. I can brush both sides, top and bottom of the middle finger, and I brush the outfinger. Now I've got 6, I check 7, and then I check 8. And I do both sides at the same time with the person. They just have their arms out. We can go all the way down and check these things out. Now, I've got some pictures in a moment here to show you how to do this. And you just simply move on to the next. And often you don't need to test, certainly all the, I mean, there's no use me testing the, you know, the lumbar, the lower body, if that has no symptoms. My symptoms are in my shoulder, my arm, or my hand, right? So you don't have to do all of it at any given time, but just simply those that could be pertinent to the area we're looking at. So in the, this is a list, I'll just leave it here. I'll probably also, just as I put the notes from the excerpt from my book on my website, I'll give you the information at the end. I probably will put the slides there so people want to look at them, but this is even out of my book. This just gives you the way they would give it, C1 and 2, back of the head or behind the ears, above the clavicle you could brush, below the clavicle you could brush, lateral shoulder and down the lateral tailbone, the whole thumb, you know, both sides of the middle finger, ulnar border, and then inside of the arm. And in 10 seconds, you can have 10 or 15 seconds, you could have tested all the upper dermatomes and you know which ones are, oh, I gotta look at this. Right. So this is just put some pictures here as you show doing it. So he's testing C6, C7, C8, right? Now, myotomes, that myotome chart, we had, you know, all this cervical flexion, cervical side bending, whatever. Again, if they've complained about weakness, you could have them perform these actions while you resist it. And you resist it several times because someone might be able to resist strongly. And then the second time, oh, is that just maybe almost, oh, and it fades. So that does let you know there's maybe a more minor problem rather than just, oh, I got nothing at all. It might be, yeah, they can push and then push again. Oh, it's getting lighter and lighter and now I can't push anymore. So there are some things, and I bring that up in the book, but those are things that can be learned rather quickly. And a positive sign with this is not just weakness, because that could be a sprain, a strain, ruptured tendon, all sorts of things. What it is weakness without pain, right? So, or some people say unexplained weakness. There was no injury that's been talked about in terms of to that area. There's nothing visible. You can't see anything else with other types of testing. And when they have this weakness, it's without pain. If it has pain, then it's probably a muscle strain or an injury to the muscle, tendon, or even a ligament. But if there is no pain, then this is a distinctive thing for testing a myotome when you do this resisted muscle testing. If pain is experienced when testing, then there's a likelihood of a muscle strain, right? Some other pathology. So we can move on from that. And so here I just give again the myotomes of the upper body. And here's just an example of a few of them, C4, C5, and C6, about how you would do them. You just often stand behind the person to start, and you can do, you know, the flexion, the side bending, and you move around, and you try to as often as possible, do them bilateral, but you often, with resistive testing, you have to do one side, but follow it immediately by the other side and compare. Unfortunately, there is more, but we don't have the time to go into that. And this is about peripheral nerves in terms of axillary nerves, ulnar nerve, etc. This is when nerve roots have blended together, and now that nerve is not a nerve root anymore. We call it a, you know, peripheral nerve proper. But while they might seem that, well, wouldn't this confuse everything about dermatomes and myotomes? Not really, not for dermatomes, in the sense that because two or three nerve roots could be involved, the area of sensation that would be changed is larger than just the small dermatomal areas. So I'd do this here. Oh, I got an altered sensation here on my left. Oh, and I have it here too. Well, it probably means it's more peripheral nerve. But again, that just complicates the issue, and let's not complicate the issue. Let's see if we can get to some more. I want to get to this pain part for sure. So here, dermatomal and referred pain. Hopefully we go on for a few more minutes, if that's okay. So referred pain, I have here that deeper structures sharing the same nerve root may express pain through their corresponding dermatome. These structure tissues, organs, bone, and joint tissues are deep muscles. These are all the types of tissues that can be involved here. Now, the more superficial a tissue is, the more likely the site of injury is where you're feeling the sensation. So what I do, when I'm talking with clients about some of this referred pain issue, because they're saying, why are you treating me over here when I feel the pain over there? When you get a paper cut, the most superficial thing we have is our skin. When you have a paper cut, you can find it right away. You know where it is, right? Brain's very good at being distinct about that. On the other hand, when something is deeper, the brain sort of gets a little vague about where that is. And so there is a neurological rule that an area of that's being affected that has low sensation, if that shares the same nerve root as it, and that nerve root goes somewhere where it's more superficial, somewhere on the skin, for example, that's where the brain will read the pain is coming from, right? So the deeper something is, the more likely it is to refer at a bit of distance from the area, in fact, sometimes quite far away. So referred pain characteristics is, this is from a particular James Wassner. Radiation is related to spinal segmental area. So what we're talking about is you feel it shoot all the way down the nerve, right? So you turn your head and then you get the shooting pain that comes all the way down and follows the C6 area, okay? That's when we use the term radiation. Perceived pain and pathology are on the same side of the midline. This is sort of a rule. So while we say it refers at a distance, it's very rare for you to feel pain, referred pain somewhere, and not have the lesion on the same side of the body. And referred pain, one of its qualities is usually, though, it is, even though it's on a dermatomal area, it can feel deep. But great for therapists who've, we all have this experience where if someone, let's just say something is quote unquote, not really simple, but low back pain, the client can sort of say, it's achy back here, but I poke around or you poke around for them and you can't find anything is sore, right? You can't find any tenderness there. So this referred distally within a dermatome, but not necessarily through the whole dermatome. The author has agreed, this author has agreed. So what can happen is, I find this a lot with people who have low back pain, and there might be some issues going on with the muscles there, but it doesn't seem to explain the pain and we can't recreate their pain. But then I work on the top of the glute muscles just under the crest of the hip, and they jump and the brain has decided that those deeper muscles under the big glute, they are getting read by the brain as coming from the low back, when in fact they aren't. but they're related to the low back in the sense is, you know, when I bend forward and I come back up, it's those muscles that are bending me forward and up. My low back muscles are really just keeping my spine together in a certain sense. So there may be in some situations, because things vary. So you could have a referred pain that's really, really close, maybe even over, just broader. Like there's a small injury here, but you got it here. Or it can be shifting off a little bit, or it can be at quite a distance. So that's what it means by it may be continuous with or maybe separated from pain, the pain origin. And he points out this sixth principle he wishes to add, that the site of perceived pain is not tender, whereas the site of pathology is tender. And that's your biggest thing about referred pain. If you are palpating and they say you're trying to find out something in here is bothering you, is it a scalene? Is it my upper trap? Is it whatever? And if I'm pressing around and that's where they said the pain has been, but I don't get a tender spot, then that's not likely where the origin of the source of the issue is coming from. So dermatomes though, if it's happening, if these things, referrals happening on a dermatonal pattern, all I have to do is I have to think of, okay, this is a C6 dermatome. What are the muscles, for example, with trigger points, what are the muscles that use C6 as part of their innervation? And there can be a number of them. And so then I can go check those muscles. And then I can see, this one, I find a tender point. I find a trigger point, what have you. Okay. So that's where dermatomes can help you find referred pain. Because if you think of it, if you just go and say, I'm palpating here, I cannot reproduce that pain, we can't find any tender spot, then you throw your hands up? No, but if you realize that, okay, the pain they're talking about seems to be on this dermatome, maybe even one or two, then I can go back knowing what roots that comes from. Okay, what muscles, for example, are innervated by that nerve root? What joint capsules or ligaments are innervated by that nerve root, right? To share that dermatonal area in terms of the nerve root. And then I can explore those tissues to find that problem. So that to me is a pretty useful tool when things aren't straightforward. And as we all know, I'm sure with our experience, someone comes in, it's all straightforward, sort of have an idea what's going on, check it out, yep, that's what's going on, and you can treat it. But then you get those ones where, well, you may be feeling this here, but it doesn't, you know, make any sense. Now, then we get to look very sort of magical, because when you've done this for a long enough time, you know, we start to relate certain areas of the body and the muscles that share the same nerve roots. And you say, here, I'm going to press it. Look, I can press at your shoulder and we can make that pain appear as if it was down in your wrist, right? And it all looks very magical and mysterious, but, practice makes perfect. Anyway, so a great magic trick you can learn if you learn about dermatomes with your clients. Okay, so we have these terms, and you could see them when you're reading materials. So radicular pain is nerve root pain. So when I talk about a dermatome is sensing pain, and it's originating from that nerve root, that is radicular pain. That's the term they will use. What happens too, which is interesting, it's not unusual that the pain is felt not through the whole dermatonal area, but at the usually the end of it. Then there seems to be a general rule of thumb that if that persists, more chronic that becomes, then it will travel up. So people may find this with sciatica, that people will talk about they've got pain in their heel and their lower leg, back of their lower leg. And that's how it starts off. And then, you know, no one's been able to help them with this. So they thought it would go away and they keep going, avoiding getting some treatment or taking care of it. And now it's traveling up the back of the leg, then into their buttock. So that can often happen with radicular pain. Now, radiating pain, it travels from the site of injury. So it starts at my shoulder and shoots down the arm into my hand. And this can be either a radicular or it could be a referred pain. So. And neuritis is, when we talk about nerve pain, neuritis is pain that's sourced from within the nerve. What we mean by that, the nerve itself is inflamed. We got to remember that when nerves get compressed a short period of time, you've got a disc bulge on it, or you've got some piece of bone rubbing on it, they, like every other tissue in the body, get inflamed. And that inflammation can sort of travel down or be felt along the whole list, and the inflammation can grow. So someone with some very bad sciatic who's had it for a long time, yes, they got low back, but let's say it's from piriformis compression. But now if you palpate, if it's new, you palpate under the knee, you don't feel anything particular. Now when you palpate on these 6 months later, you find out that you can feel almost a swollen cord there, and it's very tender. But the nerves themselves, you got to remember, do can swell from injury. Okay. Maybe again, I don't know whether we want to stop here, because as you see, the topic starts to grow. But if you want to, I just have two slides on embryology if you just wanted to.
Well, if you're happy, I love embryology, so.
Okay, yes, it's, I don't know enough about it.
But it's
a massive field, but it's everything I read at any given point, just smack my head. Anyway, so dermatomes, myotomes, and sclerotomes, strictly speaking, embryologists will slap you around for talking about dermatomes and myotomes in your body. Because for them, the terms were originally given for what they called these paired somites, which surround the body of the initial embryo. And what it talked about, these somites would then give rise to certain types of tissue. And they're usually paired, and they run from the head of the first days old embryo to the bottom, tip to toe. Now, in very general terms, in the developing human embryo, the dermatome somites form the dermis, or deep skin, and the superficial fascia. That dermatome is not just neural, it's also the tissues. So what is going to create my skin, and we call it the dermis because we call the top the epidermis, because those are actually dead cells that are flaking off, right? But the dermis underneath, which is the living tissue where everything's happening here, keep generating these protective cells on top. Anyway, that comes from what is called the dermatonal somite. But along with that tissue, of course, it pulls all the nerve with it, right? So it pulls, and so dermatomes are nerves in the way we were talking, but they are also the tissues, in this case, the dermis, and some of the superficial fascia. So myotome somites first form the musculature of the vertebral column and ribs, and the deep fascia is sometimes called movement fascia. So these are the ones that wrap around muscles or compartments and organize them into, you know, groups of muscle and function. And you notice here it's talking about the vertebral column and ribs, because this is the first thing that happens. And the sclerotome somites, before limbs occur, limb buds occur, sclerotome somites first form the vertebral column, the ribs, and the occipital bone, most of the occipital bone. And then after those are formed, then these things go on, of course, expand. The skin is always on the outside very early on, and so that's probably why the dermatomes are relatively, from person to person, pretty set. The musculature, of course, grows and is shaped by demand, so neural innervations could have some variety. Bone goes on for a long time, and even after birth, it's developing. So that's probably why the nerve roots are not as cleanly, if you want to put that, however, we want to put that to a specific area of bone only. Anyway, and just interesting to know that the bones of the cranial vault, in fact, don't come from this sclerotome at all. They come out of what's called the neural crest, the very origins of what's going to be our brain, which is a fascinating point. And certainly when I heard that one in my early days, when I was long ago studying some cranial osteopathy, made me think a little bit, right? About, well, yeah, maybe the cranial bones are a little different than the rest of my body. Anyway, As time goes on, the limbs form, their bone and muscle evolve out of the sclerotomes and myotomes, but not as early as you said, all that, hence various nerve roots may vary. Okay. I think I have one more here. So there is another thing called synodontomes, or different people say it differently. Somites give rise to joint capsules, ligaments, and cartilage. And in many ways, they are being thought of recently as an a somite in and of itself, and some of them are thought of as simply a somite, so to speak, that evolves out of the myotome and creates, you know, the connective tissue that's so involved in the movement of the body. Okay, so the first reason for mentioning all of this is to show how elements of the peripheral nervous system, and that's nerve roots out, the sensory and motor, get related to specific tissues and their functions. So really a study of dermatomes and myotomes can be just, I'm just doing this for an assessment to know whether a nerve root has a problem, but in reading about them and then reading about the physiology of the nervous system, you get a bigger picture of how the human is organized. So they are the very fabric of the movement body, you might want to call it. So those therapists who are interested in movement therapy, from kinesiologists, Feldenkrais people, massage therapists, physios, etc. You see how this whole element of neurology mixed with embryology can lead to some very interesting insights into what's going on. And the second reason is to make an observation about all of this, that the movement body, that's the muscle skeletal system, a little extra, is integral to the whole body. It certainly is part of our embodiment. The CNS, the central nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, we haven't even talked about the autonomics in relation to these issues, the circulatory system, organs, glands, etc. These are all integrated, and any change in any one of these systems will emanate throughout our whole being. So you can't, while, you know, you might sprain an ankle, and yes, the issue is local at the moment. If that, depending on how that's treated or not and how severe, slowly but surely, every aspect of your body is going to be affected. Because it's not just, say, you rolled over and you sprained this ligament and maybe strained this muscle, but now you've changed the proprioceptors. So now the neural input, the sensory input, right, how the motor nerve will function or be inhibited to function, not let you walk, make you limp so that you can't use that joint. You can see all sorts of ways that all of this, you know, feeds back into the whole person as a whole. So, right. So changes in any of our systems will emanate throughout our whole being, informing, inhabiting, and becoming who we are. And certainly that's exactly how we've talked about myotomes and dermatomes. We're talking about sensory information and movement and how they come right to the core of run into our central nervous system and part of the whole regulatory element of who and what we are. So it can become, the picture can be small and it could be very big. And hopefully that wasn't all too confusing. As I say, that's why I'll put these notes up, the slides up as a PDF, and later today or tomorrow. And I already have there some other things.
I've just put that up. I'm just going to put that up on the chat, actually. That page there, if people want to click on that.
So right. So that's where they could find the PDF. It's about 10-12 pages that I copied right out of the textbook. It's all on the cervical dermatomes and myotome testing, etc. And you can get there's lots of pictures. And I like lots of pictures. And so you can get a sense of the flow of how you would do things and how it's not as complicated. The testing isn't as complicated as you think. And then the next slide, I believe, is the one that would have the code that if you were interested in buying the book, where you could get a discount if you when purchasing. That Handspring sent to me today.
Great. So EHL 10, and that's free shipping as well within the USA and the UK. And I'll just put that link up there now to the page you can order that from as well, from Handspring. And just do that now for you. Great. Well, thank you so much, David. That was really amazing. A lot of information there. Fantastic. And so please do have a look at David's book. And any last words you want to say, David, before we stop?
I've got this here. I don't need that, never. Well, the topic was disarmingly complicated in some sense. You know, when I first think of dermatomes and myotomes, because of my training, at first they say, well, that's pretty simple. Yeah. Scenario of skin, da 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 da, and I know my testing, whatever. But when you start, as I say, to how are you going to convey that to other people? And you've got to have some hook that might hook into what they know about.
Yeah.
You can see how it's complicated, but not in a, not in a distressing way. It's complicated in, as I say, this, I use the term embodiment. And I think this is, for me, what clinical assessment became. It became a way of seeing how, you know, we are embodied in the world and how we are reacting to the world, reacting to our own self, our deeper self, and to others. And all of this plays a role. Mm. So that we know that, for example, that if you talk about, you just use pain. Pain isn't just, you know, a nociceptor, I hurt something, I smash it on a rock or something. It's also the social world I live in, right? It's the psychological elements that come to play. There's all of these things. And assessment really, we try to, you know, like all subjects, we try to cut off little bits and talk about them individually. But the importance I find of learning, yes, you have to learn them this way. But what becomes really fascinating is when you then start to try to put them back together and you start seeing these interconnections. And I would say that it's assessment that led me to osteopathy. I mean, I practice a lot of, I remain a massage therapist because I choose to, but I use an awful lot of osteopathic techniques in my practice. And I do so because I think, let's put it the other way around. If you want to know what clinical assessment is, all you have to do is think through your anatomy. You could invent all the tests, all the aspects of assessment on your own if you really understand anatomy and physiology. If you know how the body works, how joints move, how muscles move, how the blood feeds the system, how the nerves interact, the autonomic system, etc. When you have that information, you can compose all of these things. You can make new tests. I always say, tell students, listen, if you know, when you get to know your anatomy well enough, if you couldn't remember a test, you could make it up, you could invent it. You might even invent a better test. Mm-hmm. Same with techniques. All of our techniques that people modalities learned in manual therapy come from our understanding of anatomy. Mm-hmm. And to me, clinical assessment is just thinking anatomy, thinking of the consequences of anatomy and what, you know, how the body works well and how the motor system works well and how it might fall apart and how to get it back to where it was. So I would say that that would simply be my point, that if you want to learn more about clinical assessment, keep learning more about anatomy, and then the assessment always makes sense.
Wonderful. Mariel Vanderburg is just saying that, thank you, David, for writing this beautiful book. It's a wonderful compilation of so many things you want to know as a therapist. That's a very good endorsement.
Okay. I've had good feedback, and why another assessment book? I think a lot of manual therapists weren't well served, as I say, because of the heavy jargon and technical descriptions, and that we don't come with that to our profession often. And so I purposely struggled with it. So this is a compilation of my struggles and watching other students struggle and trying to help them to simplify and make it applicable to what you're doing.
Yeah, I think we've definitely seen that today in your presentation, that it's very easy. Well, a complex subject, but you made it easy to understand. So that's really great.
And I get excited about it like a geek. So
that's great.
It's only a strange person who gets excited about clinical assessment on the whole most of the time, I find.
That's wonderful.
That's okay.
Great. So the link is up there to David's book. And just to say, we've got a few things coming up on eHealth Learning. Tomorrow is the last in a series of three with Dean Juhan. He's going to be doing his part three of his course on unwinding the neck and the cranium. And that you can get that. If you want to join it, you can still join it. And obviously these are all recorded, so you can see what he's been up to as well. On our birth journey, on our sister site, where I'm going to be doing a webinar on Thursday, looking at the ramifications of being born by suction. So that's something else. And then John Sterk is on the 8th of June. We have Deb Dana, who's going to be doing a whole series about the polyvagal theory, starting on the 23rd of June as well, next month. So thank you again, David, and love to have you back sometime. We really love
it. Sure, that. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it all.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks, everybody.
Take care. Bye-bye. Be safe.
And you. Bye-bye.